You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, March 30th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, it is Casual Friday. That means the very not casual Cliff Schechter always shows up, well, on the phone, wearing a dinner suit. Also on the program today, giving us movie recommendations, the thespian, star of stage, screen, and scream, Richard Kind. And of course, our songs in review, your phone calls, my irritability, all of it, all for you on this casual Friday. But first, let us play Cliff Schechter's theme song.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is always a pleasure to welcome to the show every Friday, Cliff Schechter.
Am I being welcomed, Sam?
Welcome, Cliff. Of course.
I just want to make sure that was the point where I responded. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing all right. I fired a member yesterday in the post-show of the show yesterday, in the better half of our program. I fired a member.
Wow.
I am just now sort of like calming down. But I.
What was the transgression?
I just didn't appreciate they left a comment on the blog that was factually inaccurate about the quality of the show. I mean, you know, I have no problem when people say, like, I don't want to listen to your show anymore because politics are depressing, or why do I need a play-by-play as we spiral down into the abyss, or...
You have that jackwad Cliff Schechter on who really doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. Yeah, I understand that.
That doesn't bother me, but when somebody
says... I have trouble with myself sometimes.
Somebody says, like, you don't do enough interviews, or your interviews are all rehashes. You know, we've done on this program now... We've done over 300 shows over the past year and a half, and we've probably done well over 300 interviews. We occasionally, you know, we'll replay an interview when I go on vacation from Ring of Fire, but probably that represents less than 1% of the interviews. And then,
you mean you're allowed to go on vacation?
Well, you know, I'm
you're lazy. What the hell's your problem, Sam?
The thing that really bothered me is somebody said, you know, like, to be a member on this program, it's $10 a month, which is more expensive than the podcasts that you get from radio shows. But we have no radio revenue. We have no ad revenue. We have no corporate sponsorship. I don't go on and say buy gold or gold penis enlargers or anything like that. I don't do that. And I'm not saying that.
I distinctly remember you doing an ad for gold penis enlargers at some point in the past.
If I found the right one, if I found one that was very effective, then yes, I would do that.
So wait, does it turn your penis to gold and enlarge it? I would think there'd be a serious market for that.
No, that, of course, I would promote, because that's both a social utility and an investment value. But you don't do 3 hours. Well, everybody knows that a 3-hour radio show has 48 minutes, I think it is, of advertising time. So,
and you also do Ring of Fire, and you know, listen, no, I got no, to jump no, in your
tater. Listen, I do other things subsidize, sure, but that's not the point. But the point is no, like, but, I do at least 90 minutes, sometimes 100 minutes a day of content, which is virtually identical to what I would do on a 3-hour radio show if I had 22 minutes an hour of commercials. So
I need to say this because I'm first of all, I obviously, as someone who writes and appears on things, you know, I get stuff in comments, and I'd say much more often, of course, it's people being fantastic and supportive than the negative side. I'm sure it is with you too. But from that perspective of somebody who does this kind of stuff, and then the perspective of somebody who's enough of a jackass to invest in a radio station in D.C., which I'm happy about, but my God, the things you learn, as you know from conversations with me, Sam, the ways it complicates your life and makes life difficult at times and makes you work harder than you ever wanted to. I think most of your listeners, I would say literally like 99% of them probably understand this, but it is really hard putting together a radio show. You know, and I'm not just saying this to kiss your butt or anything. I'm saying this honestly. You're a friend, but you're all, you know, also I know this from things I do. I mean, I think hopefully I think most of the people do understand, but if they don't, the kind of work, you know, I mean, it's your own business and it's a radio show. And so when you're gone for a week, you know, you're allowed to, that's why I made that joke. You're allowed to take vacations too, by the way. And you know, you've got to do everything. You're a one-man show. You're providing the content. You're doing the booking. You know, I mean, you've got those. I shouldn't say it's a one-man show because you have those wonderful gentlemen in the studio there with you who help. The lady wasn't there when I stepped in the studio that time, so that must be a new addition. I apologize, lady. By the way,
got rid of one of the gentlemen.
Well, he was probably a dick anyhow. but you know, you people help you. I shouldn't put it that way, but you know, you have to market it. I mean, you have to do all these different things. It is a lot of work. I know. I have my own business too, and when you have to actually do the content and you have to market whatever.
My feeling is as having been essentially in one form or another been producing content professionally for 20 some odd years. The audience shouldn't have to care about that or whatnot, but I just don't like the mischaracterization of the amount of that's what really pissed me off. I think it was the 90
minutes. Just saying, I think people should understand that you are putting time in.
That doesn't make any
sense. I'm not saying it does. I'm just saying you put time in, people put time in, and I never want to make it sound like, because I'm always careful to say, you know, when I say I work hard, I put that in quotes. You know, anybody out there working, doing like a real job, like construction or cleaning something up or a variety of ways, people who are underpaid and overworked work harder than I do. So I don't ever try to make it sound like I'm some hero. I'm just saying for people that don't understand what goes into a radio show, you know, you put your time in. And I think you're
I don't know that I'm done. That's all. Accusing me of slacking. I just don't, you know, it's just, I don't know. There was something about the sort of the amount of content, which would teed me off. But let's not make this too meta, because this week, fascinating week. There were two basic, you know, sort of prominent stories this week. I personally don't think that enough time, frankly, in what I saw in the corporate media was spent on the Supreme Court. You know, that's why I have my own show. But one of the things that where was talk, we, you know, we spoke last week about the Trayvon Martin case. What is fascinating to me about the Trayvon Martin case, and I want to get to the Supreme Court, but let's just touch on this for a minute. The thing that really fascinates me, and I, you know, I'll repeat what I said last week. I don't like the idea of trying anybody from a distance. But I do think there are clearly instances where some people should be arrested and put through the judiciary find out. I mean, you know, and this one is clearly one of them. But what amazes me is how the right wing in this country has sort of formulated somehow the idea of demonizing Trayvon Martin has become part of their ideology. I just don't understand it.
Well, it seems like the Breitbart Empire proving that even after his untimely passing can still remain in the gutter. Dana Loesch just makes me want to vomit. That whole group are still, they're doing their thing to try to, he's a gangster and he's using gangster signs. I had a few of these people tweet this garbage at me. Oh, black on black violence. Yeah, let's talk about that. That definitely is what this, you want to hide from black on black violence. I had one of those idiots. I mean, they'll just, anything they can do to actually prove what racist they are. And then, Tucker Carlson is climbing in that gutter too. These people are unbelievable. I guess I still would think at this point I wouldn't be able to be shocked by them, and I am. No compassion, and nothing. And again, I've never tried George Zimmerman in the media. I don't think you have either. I think the argument I've made is, let's see, the guy was arrested in 2005 for assaulting a police officer. He had his intent anger management classes. He called in his very own voice told 911 he was following an armed kid, and he was armed and made a comment that sounded a lot like a racist comment. And in addition to all that, disobeyed their direct, when they told him not to follow him, he followed him. So isn't that, when you combine just all of that and then shot him, of course, isn't that enough for an arrest? I mean, that's all that I think I haven't heard every commentary you've made on this, but certainly when you and I talked, and this is what I've said on it, which is, to me, that's a clear case of if anybody else did that anywhere else, they would be in prison. At least they would have been arrested, and a jury would make this determination. You know what I mean? And I don't see how there was not enough evidence with all of that.
I will even go sort of just beyond that. It's just, I just don't understand the mentality of we need to demonize this. Now, when a guy from a self-avowed Klansman, and, it's hard to know these things, but when a self-avowed Klansman goes and hacks into his email accounts and his social media accounts, I'm speaking of Trayvon Martin's, and posts them online, and then also neglects to post on that, like, his email account was just full of stuff like, I'm going to take SATs, how do I prep for the SATs, what colleges should I go to, this type of thing. But it is – I understand why a Klansman would do that. I mean, because Klansmen, really sort of central to being a Klansman is being a huge racist. I don't understand why these, I don't know what you call the things that hang on to a dying carcass and sort of live off that carcass. Some type
Tucker
of parasite.
Carlson?
Yeah, the Breitbart parasites.
Is that what you call
and,
them?
Well, Tucker Carlson's obviously trying to sort of fill that void that, Breitbart left. And hopefully we won't find out in a couple of weeks when the toxicology report comes in that Carlson's going to have to engage in all sorts of behavior that he would have otherwise passed up on. But that's not the point. My point is that I don't understand why these people are so compelled to try and make the case that Trayvon Martin was a bad person, even if he was a bad person. Even if this guy spent his days, going down to a boiler room, let's say, at a brokerage house and selling derivatives to old ladies in pensions, even if he was that bad of a person, it doesn't matter. He doesn't deserve to be shot.
I suspect that you know the answer to this as well as I do. I mean, it's sort of right in front of you, and we've been talking about this forever, which is, again, it's modern conservatism is your answer. It's that it's not based on a rational disagreement like it used to be when, you had some center-right Republicans, Rockefeller Republicans, others that were somewhat more conservative would argue with Democrats over things, but they would try to find common ground, and they both were behaving in what they thought was the interest of the country. It's that modern conservatism is based on, you making an argument somewhere, like saying, I really believe people need Social Security because it will help them in their old age, or I really believe that we should not have stand-your gun laws because it leads to innocent people dying. And the response from the other side is, you commie, you pinko, you black lover, you Jew, that is the response because there really is a lack. And I'm not saying, there are some rational still conservatives here and there who I have the actual debates with. But conservatism is mostly just, it's not conservatism. It is directly reactionary is what it is these days. It's this blind, paranoid, angry reaction that it's kind of like the way the Republicans have reacted to Obama. Well, we used to be be for that mandate thing. He's for it now. It must be terrible.
Right.
We used to be for cap and trade. He's for it now. It must be terrible. It's just a negative reaction to anything we stand for and imputing motives upon us that, like, we hate the country or, you know, that we want to convince everyone in the world to try abortion or, you know, I mean, you know, you've dealt with this stuff. It's not rational, and that's this reaction.
Well,
you know,
I mean, the reaction is only if you see it through the prism of these people are trying. This is so much about identity politics, which, of course, they deride, but it's really about them shaping their identities not around any type of cohesive worldview other than whatever people I deem to be the left or the liberals.
That's exactly right.
Are supporting is the only way that I can define my conservatism is in reaction to what you're And it's not
exactly
even
you,
in reaction.
You brought up this.
Look, these are reactionaries, but they're not even reacting to changes in societal policy. They're simply reacting to a perceived notion they have of a group of people and what their values are.
Right.
And not even the values. They're just responding willy-nilly to whatever, you know, if we came out and said, you know what? Trayvon Martin was a horrible person. He deserved to be shot. It would. How long would it take until Breitbart.com put up, we must march for Trayvon Martin? I mean, that's basically
right. And Michelle Malkin, we get on that, like, that right. cheerleader suit of hers and make another idiotic video in favor of Trayvon Martin. And I mean, that's it. That's that. And you made this point a few weeks ago because a guy I used to be friendly with, and you know, you and I both know, who's a Breitbart guy, and I don't even want to mention his name and deal with it. But you know, who sent out a tweet that he'd now become conservative because liberals were lying about this. And I think you made that point a couple of weeks ago when I was on the show, which is that so you become conservative in reaction to something somebody liberal said. The reason you and I consider ourselves liberals or progressives is because we care about certain things. It's not in reaction to what some right wing idiot is saying or doing. They don't. When they write something, my immediate reaction isn't to be like, I'm going to hate it because they're conservative. You know, that's the thing is that that explains this situation. That explains a lot of what we deal with. Explains what Barack Obama misunderstood. That you couldn't sit down and deal with these people because they're not, you know, arguing from a place of I think this is best for the country, but I respectfully disagree with you. There are a few Republicans like that left. There are. I don't want to say it's everybody. There are some people like that left, but for the most part, it's just an angry counter-reaction, you know, a reaction to what we believe because we must be evil or bad because that's what they've been told by Rush Limbaugh and other people. It's a completely emotional reaction. It's not rational, and it doesn't. In the end, there's no way that you can come to an agreement with that. So
this tees up the question of the Supreme Court this week actually quite nicely because what we're seeing now is a tremendous amount of, at least in liberal establishment circles and in the administration circles, it's sort of this sort of strange notion of surprise at the way that Scalia and Alito, and frankly, maybe Roberts and Kennedy, for that matter, have responded to the Affordable Care Act. Now, I want to say one thing up front. I'm not in favor of the mandate per se. But that's different from saying that the mandate is clearly constitutional. And
yeah.
And so let me just preface that because I've gotten some response like, wow, you really love this mandate. I didn't know about it. I think there are some very good things about the Affordable Care Act, and I've come to learn that. The mandate to me is really sort of secondary of a problem that I have with maintaining, frankly, the private insurance industry, which is clearly a failed industry, and this is essentially a bailout for that industry. But that aside, the question of constitutionality is, at least from the perspective of the vast majority of legal scholars, unpartisan legal scholars, who see this as constitutional, and many of them quote Scalia's own finding in this Raich case about a guy who grew his own medicinal marijuana. But what's amazing, though, is that we're seeing this whole sort of like surprise at, wow,
right.
These Supreme Court justices, they don't seem to care about the integrity of the institution, and they don't seem to care about the reputation of them as justices. What a surprise. Where were these people in 2000 when people, even less partisan, although Scalia was there, less partisan, picked George Bush to be president. I'm just sort of flabbergasted by the shock and outrage.
Yeah, and you know, what sealed that deal from, you know, as if it wasn't obvious at the time, which a number of people wrote books and made it, you know, and pointed out all the inconsistencies that these guys were for states' rights, you know, theoretically, and in our Constitution, you know, the states deal with elections, so they should have deferred to Florida if they really believed in anything they ever said, but of course not in this case. I mean, there were a number of these things that were complete inconsistencies with what these guys supposedly believed, but Sandra Day O'Connor later admitted, you know, in her own way, that she was sorry that she'd supported Bush, and which made it clear to me that she really did, based upon the fact that I think she thought he was going to be like his dad, be sort of a center-right Republican, and not this complete whack job. You know what I mean? And it was a political choice. You know, they're Republicans in robes, some of these guys. This has been the Federalist Society's project. It's been the project since at least the Reagan years, was to stymie Clinton and Obama and the left, whenever there's a Democratic president, from putting judges in, to slow the process down as much as possible, filibuster and the rest. And when Republicans are in, to do their best to corrupt the courts. You know, I mean, you know, one of the things I've worked with, Susan Saladoff, as you know, and I know you had her on your show. She's been a client of mine, the film Hot Coffee, about tort reform and what a joke it is and how it keeps regular people out of the courts. So one of the important things that her movie talks about beyond tort reform is the buying of these state and local elections where you vote for Supreme Court justices like we do here in Ohio and some other places do. They've, you know, the Chamber of Commerce has bought them off. And again, it's been about this same thing. The right realizes by taking over courts, you know, they can do a lot of things that they can't just do in the other two branches, and they can have the guise of it's legal precedent, which it isn't. And again, a lot of these reactions, as we started off this thing with, you know, some of them make sense if you think about it because they're pro-business or they're whatever, but a lot of them are just tribal, kind of like what we were talking about conservatives before. It's a tribalism. It's basically more like a sports contest. You know, you root for the Yankees, I root for the Yankees, you root for the Red Sox, you know, that's the way it is. And that's the way they treat our political system. And Scalia, you'd think they'd be in favor of the mandate because, again, it helps out their buddies in the insurance industry, but in a way, they're not. Because Obama's for it. It's tribalism. Well, you're for it. I have to be against it. Doesn't matter that it was the Heritage Foundation's plan in 1993. Doesn't matter that Newt Gingrich was for it, Mitt Romney was for it, Orrin Hatch was for it, Chuck Grassley was for it, and I go on and on and on and on. All these guys on the record, John McCain, their presidential candidate, in, you know, 4 years ago. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Well, it obviously is constitutional. You can disagree with the mandate. I think everybody should be covered with health insurance, and we should have to get it that way. Somehow, my preference by far would be single payer. Otherwise, in some ways, I would agree with the mandate. I just would think there need to be much more generous government subsidies so that anybody who can't afford it is fully covered. But obviously, you know, that's the worst case scenario to me. By far, my preference is single payer, and second to that would be a public option. So,
well, I mean, the it's one thing for the Republican politicians to be against this because simply they're staking out a further right position. But theoretically, the Supreme Court justices are supposed to be beyond politics. And that's what I think is so shocked. And frankly, I'm most interested to see how these establishment types react to this. You know, of course, we don't know how they're going to rule. And, you know, all it's going to take is Justice Kennedy to find.
Right. That's the only one we don't know. We know how they're going to rule. We don't know how the one swing voter is going to rule.
Right. Well, some people think Roberts, and, you know, it's conceivable if Kennedy comes out. Because what happens is, and I should tell people this, what happens is, from what I understand is, and we don't know this for sure, but more than likely their decision is going to be made public in June or early July, late June, early July, maybe mid-June. And supposedly, based upon those who know, they will make the decision probably within the next week or so. And then they will spend the next 3 months writing briefs and, describing the rationale behind their decision. It's not inconceivable that Kennedy says, I'm going to uphold the constitutionality of the mandate. That's how I'm going to vote. He votes with the four at least left of the five justices on right. those things. I hesitate to call them fully liberal, but and then Roberts says, I'm going to vote with you too in some way, because theoretically, because he's the Chief Justice, he may be more sensitive to the implications of this vote. But Jonathan Cohn has...
Gore versus Bush versus Gore, and then Citizens United, which is under Roberts. You know, I mean, I think that decision sort of solidified what Bush versus Gore already told us, which they blatantly threw out 100 years of precedent in campaign financing, you know, and overturned many state laws and other things along the way that had bans on corporate giving and the rest to do what they did, and of course be the activist judges they are. And you know, again, the issue, it comes up enough, it has lately, with Trayvon Martin, but the issue I work on, you know, a lot, which is guns, they overturned 80 years of precedent on that to claim that people had an individual right to guns. It wasn't just a group right as in a militia, which is what it says in the Constitution. So they've been more than willing to overturn long-held precedents. So why would they not find, you know, do the same thing here?
This is not just about precedent, and this is not just about Scalia finding contrary to his findings in a case just, you know, several years ago. You know, Jonathan Cohn makes a very good point here, is that there are basically two major cases in the history of the court that have struck down laws that had immediate, wide-ranging impact on society. And he's talking about Brown versus Board of Education and Roe v. Wade. Now, Brown versus Board of Education was unanimous, 9-0. The entire court basically found that separate but equal ain't going to cut it.
And it's important to say quickly, I don't want to interrupt you, Sam, but important to say quickly that Warren, to get that 9-0 ruling, because he knew how important it was in such a big issue, made some concessions. So there are a couple of things he gave up to get the lad, to get Felix Frankfurter aboard, mm-hmm. and one or two others, because he knew how important it was when you're going to make such an important decision that it not be a 5-4 Citizens United decision or a 5-4 Bush v. Gore decision.
Exactly.
You know, they so appreciated their role as the branch of government that was supposed to be beyond politics, one of the important institutional, you know, gifts, if you want to look at it that way, of what the way the Constitution, this country was set up, was there were supposed to be certain things that would, you know, block us from authoritarianism, block us from being corrupted, and the courts were supposed to be one of those, and now, again, you've got a bunch of Republicans with robes sitting there.
Look, you know, this is all part and parcel of a larger argument about the sort of demise of the professions in this country, and
yes.
sort of, you know, lawyers, you know, and I say this as somebody who was raised, I've mentioned many times, by a pack of lawyers, and
did that year,
you know,
in law school, where you learned a lot.
Well, it's not just that year in law school. I mean, my grandfather, who I was named after, was an attorney, as was five of his brothers. My grandmother remarried after my grandfather died to another attorney who, you know, worked with Frankfurter at Harvard, you know, 100 years ago, whenever that was. And, you know, so there's this notion of the legal profession being essentially like a priesthood, that they had certain obligations, and the high priests here were the Supreme Court justices, and they were above this type of thing. They found such import in the institution of the Supreme Court, and the idea was to maintain a certain amount of integrity, that they were bound not by laws, because the Supreme Court justices, you know, are not terribly bound by laws.
No,
they are
but
bound
the respect
by
for democracy,
ethics, by some code
ethics and tradition,
and right? And
certain ethics and norms and tradition, and that's the way it used to be, of course, with Congress too, until the Gingrich clan came along. You know, and I mean, they've debased so many of these different areas. Obviously, the media, we could talk about all day how that's been debased and destroyed, the role that the media used to play in society. I mean, you know, and all these, we're talking about the decline of professionalism. I mean, this has been one of the big things. This has very much hurt our society, obviously, because there used to be, at least on some level, some experts you could go to, who you know who would, and now you've got these people on the right who attack scientists, you know, as they attack the academy, as they attack anybody basically who doesn't 100% agree with them as suspect, even former Republicans. Are, you know, in many cases they attack their former brethren. I could name, you know, a dozen off the top of my head who've gone and ended up supporting causes that the Republicans suddenly don't agree with anymore. And so they become evil. You know what I mean? It's not a good thing.
So,
that's why who the hell knows what's going to happen with this thing.
Right.
You know?
And just getting back, I just want to make this point that so Brown v. Board of Education was 9-0. Roe v. Wade, which is also, you know, from a legal standpoint, a very controversial case from a legal standpoint, from a legal standpoint, that was 7-2. And you had also in that situation, it had immediate wide ranging impact. But the idea of a 4-5 decision or a 5-4 decision that would – remember what it would do. It would, regardless of what you think about the Affordable Care Act in terms of its supporting and being a bailout for the health insurance industry, which I do consider it to be, if you strike down this law with a 5-4 decision or by any decision, but in this case it will be a 5-4 decision, you are immediately – denying 30 million people health insurance. 30 million people. You will be denying the 13 million people who would be getting it through Medicaid. You will be denying another 27 million, maybe you want to just say 21 million, who would be getting insurance subsidized in some fashion. And you would be denying all those people insurance, including in their people with pre-existing conditions, including children with pre-existing conditions. You would also be immediately making insurance revert back to this failed product. This is a dramatic
and remember rescission, where they kick you off at the last minute. That's always a fun one too.
This is a dramatic sweeping move based upon what Ronald Reagan's Solicitor General said is a bunch of talking points, basically from RedState.com. And
yeah, that's the amazing thing is, again, so many of the guys that were professional, you know, you see them out there, a number of them. What's his name? Bruce Fine is one of them. Mm-hmm. These guys that were under Reagan, but they were conservative, and they still are, but they were professionals, and they took their duty as lawyers, judges, and other things seriously. You know, Stockman, I think of on the budget side, who's come out and just freaked out and decried, you know, what the Republicans are doing with the tax cuts and everything. You know, it's like it's all these ex-Reaganites, but who were still, you know, professionals at that point in time, who are just horrified by what they see going on right now. You know, and it makes you remind you of like Richard Clark and people like that. You know what I mean? I mean, on the foreign policy front,
Paul O'Neill. The list goes on and on. I mean,
you can go on and on, but with these guys who actually cared. Yes, they were Republicans. Yes, they were more conservative than you and me, but they were respectable people who cared about their country and care that whatever it is their profession is, that they're doing what they're doing right. You know, and they're doing it with the best available evidence, you know, and they make their judgment. And you and I might come to a different judgment, but their judgment is based upon sound evidence and not based upon literally, ideology. That's what you do in Stalin's Russia. You pack courts and you...
Just to take it back, hold on to this decision, because I want people to fully understand the implications of this. You have even the plaintiffs in this case, in other words, the people representing Florida and the other states that are trying to find the mandate unconstitutional. You have them admitting in court, in addition to some of the Supreme Court justices that we anticipate will be finding it unconstitutional, admitting that if this had been a tax. In other words, if it had been set up simply as a tax, everybody gets taxed X number of dollars to support this program. And if you pay for health insurance, you get it deducted off of that tax. Okay, it would be a full-on tax credit, that there would be no constitutional challenge. So they're talking about not the functioning of this law. They're talking about almost down to the semantics of this law is what they're trying to hang their hats on. And so this is a dramatic step. And here's the one question I want to ask you, because I'm convinced, and I've said over and over again. In fact, in 2000, before I, or 2001, before years before I even got into ranting about politics, at least to other people, not in my apartment at my TV. I felt that the Bush v. Gore election case was, and I have felt this throughout the past 10 or 12 years, that that case will go down in history as it, the most relevant thing in the demise of this country, of anything that has happened since then. And so I'm including, you know, 9/11 in that. I think
Well, and the economic, the wholesale deregulation, and I'm not saying that some of that didn't take place under Bill Clinton. I think that was the biggest mistake Clinton made, and I think Clinton has apologized for some of it. And I'm not even saying, even though I was, I worked for the, for his reelection in '96, when my first race out of college, and I won't, you know, I still think Clinton did a lot of great stuff, but the Glass-Steagall stuff, whatever, was terrible. But that still doesn't change the fact that what they did was what during the 2000s when Bush got in was Clinton on steroids with the economic stuff on steroids. And yes, and 9/11 when nobody was minding the shop, and the war in Iraq and the bungled war in Afghanistan not done right, so that we didn't get in and get out after after doing what we needed to do, in my opinion, there.
The tax cuts as a way of raiding Social Security. We could go on and on and on. Medicare D. We could go on.
We've destroyed our ability to function over the last 10 years, and I agree with you. I think
here's
to me,
the
beginning of the – go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
Here's the question is the reaction to that was fairly muted, and not the least by which by 9/11, because, you know, I've said this many times. September 13th, 2001, Newsweek was going to come out with a front page cover story about the fracture that existed in the Supreme Court following that Bush election 9 months later. But, of course, that was bumped because of 9/11. Do you think there's going to be a pushback on this? On this case, I mean, do you think it's going to change the way that people perceive the Supreme Court, or, and I'm talking in our elite?
Do you mean if they come to the decision, they strike this down?
Yeah,
I do. I do. I think for any process, I mean, again, everybody always uses the frog boiling in water metaphor. I think for any change, you know, like where a culture changes wholesale or a view of something changes, it happens in stages. It usually doesn't happen unless it's an enormous event where you go from one side and you completely flip to the other. So if you have faith in something, that faith needs to be shattered by one thing, but then it needs to be reinforced by something else. And usually it's a process. And if there were, and what I think is I think that first people saw the Bush v. Gore case, then they saw Citizens United, and as I brought up that gun case earlier, but most people don't follow that the way I do, and I don't think most people really understood the impact of some of those decisions until you see like what just happened to Trayvon Martin in Florida. So I think for most people it was Bush versus Gore, and then it was more recently, you know, Citizens United. And I think this is kind of the third of that triumvirate. That if they do this too, and they do it in a 5-4 fashion, how can you not look at 3 5-4 decisions in a decade or so's time, a little bit over, and just not look at the fact that this court has been radicalized? Look at what John Paul Stevens said, you know, that when he left the court after being there for, you know, for 25, 30, I don't even remember how many years, you know, a guy, he was put on under Ford, put by a Republican president who supported things like the Equal Rights Amendment, you know what I mean, in a very different age, and said that since I've been here, every justice that's been put on, with the exception of maybe one, has been more conservative than the person who left. You know what I mean? And to the point where it's radically conservative, where we easily have the most conservative Supreme Court in at least 100 years. You know, and I just don't, I do. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm doing what I always do, and I'm answering your question with a really long answer. But I think the simple answer is yes. I think that will be the reaction. I think people are going to start seeing a lot of people in a lot of places in a pretty viral way starting to dismiss the Supreme Court as someone, anybody we can trust on to protect our democracy.
Yeah, and I guess the question is, you know, how much more in tune will sort of liberals and the left get to the relevance of the court, and how much will that establishment begin to really, because it's the legal establishment that really needs to speak out and police their own in this regard, because they're the ones that maintain this fallacy about the Supreme Court that they've maintained since that finding that they could pick a president, which was a joke. I mean, that was just a joke. But
that was over that was so far over the edge of where they should have been, you know.
And it's still hard to get these guys to admit there's something seriously, seriously wrong. But Cliff, sadly, we have run out of time.
Do we have to go?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Can I ask you one quick question, though, before we go?
Yes, please.
Your grandfather had five brothers who were lawyers?
He and four others, and then I think there was a cousin. It was Cedar and Cedar.
Like the Santorum family plan? What was going on there?
It was Cedar and
Cedar.
Was
that pre-Griswold versus Connecticut?
I would walk into Cedar and Cedar, and the day I left law school to pursue a career in comedy, there was a whole raft of junior partners who just saw that they had moved up one impenetrable step on the ladder, and they were just like, follow your dream, Sam. Follow your dream.
You're funny as hell, man.
Just keep going. Keep going. Get away from this place. And everybody was going to move
Sam,
up.
Sam, you ever try meth? Yeah, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Boy.
Cliff.
Sorry, I just had to ask that question. I was impressed there were so many Cedars. That was back in the days Jews even procreated at a pretty vast rate.
In my dad's generation, there were at least three or four other Cedars in the firm, too. But now I'm basically – I've stopped at dead end tracks.
Jewish lawyers, who would have thought?
Yeah, what a surprise.
I'm sorry. I can say that, by the way.
What's that?
I can make jokes like that because I'm Jewish. I get away with it. That was my only point.
Of course. No, that's all right.
I don't want anybody angry right into your show, getting mad at your format, saying, get that guy off, that anti-Semite.
No. We've all got a great sense of humor about the Jews and the lawyers here. Cliff Schechter, as always, a pleasure. We'll speak to you next week.
Thanks a lot, buddy. Have a great week.
You too. All right, folks. We're going to take a break. When we come back, hopefully I will have Richard Kind on the program. We'll be right back after this. And he increases the number of clocks by exactly one. Everybody's coming home for lunch these days. Last night there was skinheads on my lawn.
Is an idiot.
Here it is, the Republicans' health care plan for America. Don't get sick.
If you think that's a fair ad, okay, then you're a Republican and an asshole. Have at it, Hoss. Be in that party. Despicable, man.
They're the bad guys.
Endless taxpayer bailout.
Yeah, that's not true.
When Obama won, the reason why we worked so hard for him,
we didn't want a garden variety politician taking a stand, not just cutting deals.
That's what vision is. Yeah. That's what vision is.
The Best of the Left podcast. The best of the truly liberal media. Edited, organized, and mixed. Only at bestoftheleft.com.
There's not a line that goes here that rhymes with anything. Had a dream last night, but I forget what it was.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. What a pleasure, what an honor for us to welcome to the program the star of stage and screen and, frankly, screen.
And, frankly, canceled programs.
And can't cancel programs. Of course, that comes with the territory. Of course, I'm speaking of the great Richard Kind. Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
I can't hear any applause.
You can't.
I hear no applause.
Are you serious? You can't hear any applause? Hold on. Will you turn up the sound in the... there. Yeah, we're just turning up the... That's what happened to that guy who was on...
Thank you.
What was his name now? He was on Chico and the Man. He couldn't hear any of the applause either. Or was it the laughter?
Jack Albertson.
Freddie See? Prince.
Oh, Freddie. Oh, of course. I can't hear the laughter, of course.
Right, right, of course.
Oh, good night's reference. Very good reference.
Oh, well,
now,
you.
I have to tell you, I am on a golf course right now.
You are Richard Kind hitting the links. Fantastic. How are you doing?
I'm actually hitting the ball well. My short game, not so much.
Huh.
But I'm going to hit a ball right now. Do you want to entertain everybody while I just hit a ball really, really quickly? Is
sure.
that okay?
Yes, of course. Are you driving? What are you? Where? Tell us what the club selection is.
It is a par three, about 180 yards uphill. I'm going to hit a 4-iron. I'm sure the people who love politics are dying to hear about it.
No,
this.
Well, you're going to give us a movie recommendation. I'm going to do the play-by-play. So, Richard,
okay,
stepping
okay.
up to
you
the
know
ball.
What?
He's got a 4-iron.
Speaker, can you hear me?
Yes. Here we go.
You can hear me?
Yes, I can hear
yeah,
you.
The phone is right by the ball. Literally. Can you hear this? Did you hear that?
Yes! That's a nice stroke.
That is my play. Hold on.
Here we go, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, my God. I hit the audience.
Did you hit the ball? Did you hit the ball?
Not only did I hit the ball, I hit it beautifully.
Well, there you go.
That's me. I need an audience.
This is impressive. Now, and
this is what I need. All right, let's talk. I can talk now.
Are you in like? Where are you playing in, like Cabo or somewhere fancy, like?
Like New Jersey?
Oh,
like New Jersey?
Jersey?
Like outside Tenafly?
There you go. Hey, make sure you stop by the.
New Jersey.
There's a great TGIF in Paramus. You should check out.
I am so near Paramus. a TGIF in Paramus?
Oh, there's a wonderful TGIF in Paramus. Try the mozzarella sticks.
Okay, with the marinara?
Of course.
Of course. What are mozzarella sticks without marinara?
So now this is the life of an actor who's recently been on a series that got canceled.
No. This is the life of an unemployed actor. I'm playing golf with two businessmen and a dentist. They're all working. Isn't this sort of your audience? Isn't this your target audience?
Dentists, businessmen,
and a dentist.
Yes.
Taking Friday off.
Of course. That's fantastic.
Of course. Right?
You're living the life. What? So
I am.
How was Luck? I mean, it was fun, though, right?
Oh, Sam, it was the best. It was the best, but I got to tell you, and honestly, to those, this is the first interesting thing I'm going to say on your program so far.
Okay.
To those who are listening, PETA has its heart in the right place, but its brains are up its ass. I believe in everything that PETA does, except they are not smart.
Okay. Well, now
what
wait
they
a second.
Did.
Go ahead. Tell us.
What they did to these 50 horses. Is so tragic. These 50 horses were like Dickens orphans who get saved and get to go to the judge's house and wake up in the fluffy quilts with the pillows. That's what they had. And to protect those horses, they took them away and got, I mean, HBO bought them, so they're going to find good homes, but they had the best food. They had groomers taking care of them. They had vets. Before they shot, each time they had a checkup. These horses are just going to be, you know, horses in a yard, and they, you know, maybe it's just not as good a life. And PETA thought, oh, we've got to protect them. They did. You know what it's like? It's like the kid who gets born to the alcoholic and the drug users, who gets adopted by the great family, who's given love and everything, and then all of a sudden the alcoholic mom, who has not sobered up, comes back and gets the kid again.
Wow, I've got to catch up on this. I didn't realize how involved this whole story was. So what do you say?
Oh, the whole thing is PETA. The thing is, PETA doesn't like horse racing. So in that sense, they won. Okay, they gave horse racing a bad name. So I guess in that one, but they took about 400 jobs away from people. They about 50 to 100 horses are not going to be treated nearly as well. I mean, not nearly. I mean, it's like ridiculous. It's like going from from Manhattan over to Iowa. The difference of what their life is going to be.
Well, Iowa's not such a bad place, Richard. That's a fairly...
No. Hold on. I'm not talking about the quality of life. I'm talking about the difference of life, of going from skyscrapers to the plains, of how high their life was, and now it's low. Now it's low.
Well, now, wait. Now,
you understand? I'm not...
Now, so wait a second.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let me get this straight. Now, three horses died. Right during the shooting,
yes.
Is that right?
Uh-huh.
How did they die?
Yeah, over a 2-year period. Well, I can tell you how the last one died. It was before each race, before they're being filmed. They're taken from the stable over to the veterinarian. They get a checkup, and then they go back to the stable until they take them out to the track. Well, on this one, one of the horses probably saw a bird or a squirrel or stepped in a hole and reared up and tripped and fell back. And a bone went to his head, and they had to euthanize him because, but it's like saying...
So the horses didn't die because...
I went to the doctor for a cold, and on the way back from the doctor, I died in a car accident. Did the guy die of a cold, or did he die from a car accident?
So I see. So okay. So this isn't a situation where like they're using the horses in stunts where they've got to jump from a helicopter the horses just died because they died. That could have happened to the horse anywhere, is what you're saying.
Anywhere, and horses are. I mean, I got to tell you, they're beautiful, they're strong, they're lovely and kind, but they're not smart, and horses die. They just do more often than
not. Well, we all die. I mean, but this would have been the functional equivalent.
No. But they often die from accidents or from tripping. They're fragile. They're more fragile creatures than anything else. So when a horse dies, it's treated tragic. Remember, these are beloved animals, but they're trained and they're strong and they're beautiful and they live to race. Some of them, it's really sort of lovely. They know when they lose a race. They know when they win a race. They truly know love, and it's very funny how what they're like.
I had heard was that their three horses had died, and I guess I had assumed that they had died because in the course
because
of shooting.
They were being overused.
Right.
I think the first one that may have happened. I think that it may have been a day where it was too hot, or I truly don't know what it was. They're not being overused because the American Humane Society is there to monitor everything, as well as people who know and love horses. I mean, there was a wonderful guy, I won't mention his name because I'm sure that he's living in such sadness at people pointing fingers to him, oh, you're the guy. But these people, the horses are their lives. You know, they're going to do everything they can to protect the horse, everything. And it's almost, it's sad. I feel bad for this guy who was handling the racehorses. He handled them at Santa Anita. You know, he knows them. Well, these people know horses backwards and forwards.
Right.
PETA, by the way, does not. PETA does not know horses backwards and forwards. All they know is, the horses are racing. Or they should be let out to romp and have a good time. Well, who's going to pay you? It costs about $30,000 to $40,000 to keep a horse each year. About $30,000 to $40,000. Well, who's got the money to do that?
Wow.
Honestly, who has the money?
Richard, I had absolutely no idea. Boy, that dentist,
sure.
Those dentists and those businessmen must be just like, what is going on? You see, so passionate about this horse thing. I had no idea. I really had no idea. It sounds like you're about to go out there and start to protest.
No. What I will protest is the power of... the internet right now in disseminating wrong facts and figures, and there's no beating it. I tell you what, I'm going to make a putt right now, okay? Can
sure.
you hold on?
Of course, yes. Of course.
I'll put you on the speaker.
Yes, of course.
Okay. Speaker. Hold on.
And Richard now lines up the putt. This one, I think, breaks a little bit to the left.
Giving me a rhythm.
And it breaks a little bit to the left. And... Oh. He's going to have to two-putt that, ladies and gentlemen. That's
going to
hurt him.
I am going to have to two-putt that. You heard exactly right. I'll be finished in 1 second, guys. Hold on.
Is this great radio or what, ladies and gentlemen? It's like, it's like you get the Masters and didn't Tiger Woods just won his first tournament in like 3 or 4 years. I wonder if that's what did that bring you back onto the links? Or you go ahead, make a shot, Richard. I know it's
I've done it. I two putted it.
Bad form for me to be talking.
I am in pocket. I am in pocket. Yes, I'm playing music while I'm putting.
I'm so sorry.
Are you out of your mind? You out of your mind, Sam?
Did that bring you back into the green? The Tiger Woods thing, or what?
You know, I actually was with somebody the other day who at a golf course said, I will pay I'll bet you $10,000 that Tiger Woods does not win another major. This was like 2 weeks ago. And now he'd be $10,000 short.
Was that Mitt Romney who made that bet?
No, nobody would know, but a guy. Oh, okay. A person with a name and $10,000 to waste. But, yes, he claimed that Tiger Woods was never going to. Will he be the Tiger Woods we used to know? I hope to God. But he's a good golfer.
All right. Now, Richard, I'm looking at your IMDb page. I want to ask you a question. Now, I want you to say, I'm going to ask you what has been, because you've been on so many sort of like, I mean, sort of iconic shows. Mad About You, Spin City. I mean, of course, you were in a Serious Man, which was an incredible.
Curb Your Enthusiasm will probably go down.
But I'm talking like as a regular, as a staple, too, right? I mean, what was of the.
I should be much wealthier than I am.
Well, you know, I know you go out, you play golf on Fridays. You know, you could be using this time right now to be. I don't know, selling, you could be doing all sorts of different things. I mean,
paving roads, you're absolutely right.
You're absolutely right. Doing anything. What was the funnest thing that you've ever been in? I don't want you to say those two episodes of Spin City that I was on.
I got to tell you, I think that when I do plays, that's where I have the most fun.
Really?
That's usually the most enjoyable, yeah. In fact, I'm going to be doing a play on Broadway. Starting rehearsals in August, previews in October.
What is the play?
It's called The Prince of Broadway, and it is a retrospective of Hal Prince's shows from the Pajama Game up to the present.
Wow.
It's
awesome.
Unbelievable. That's Phantom of the Opera and West Side Story and Sweeney Todd and the Pajama Game and Damn Yankees. And it goes Follies and On the Way to the Forum. It just goes on and on and on. On and on and on. Cabaret, everything. He's won 27 Tony Awards, Hal Prince has.
Yeah.
So you can imagine what this is going to be. It's really great.
That sounds like fun. Yep. I've actually seen you. We were at the RFK. There was an RFK, I think we mentioned that there was a RFK event, Ripples of Hope, and you did a tremendous monologue. And there was several actors who came up and did monologues of people who. What was that monologue of?
I don't remember.
Yes,
but it was here's what I do remember. They were all prisoners of their political prisoners
and,
in some country, and it was a guy who was a political prisoner, and I read his words.
And it was pretty
it was
amazing
not,
because
they were not mine.
You know, I got to say that there were other great actors there. They did a great job. But Nikki and I both looked at each other afterwards and goes, Richard was amazing. And I had no doubt. But I mean, I hadn't seen you sort of perform in that type of, that type of work. You know, I'd seen you perform live, but it was you and I going back and forth on Spin City. The material was just not as meaty.
That is true. But did you watch any of Luck?
Yes. Of course, we watched every episode. You were great in it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, if you saw me do Luck, I guess you would figure that I could do that.
Well, we saw Luck after that.
Oh, okay. All right. So, yes, that speech is, well, it's gorgeous. I mean, and heartfelt, because probably I put into it what I felt for the guy. I mean, there's the horrors of being a political prisoner. Now I'm talking your audience's language. But it really was. It was quite, quite beautiful. But that was a whole beautiful evening.
It was
a great, great evening. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was very, very honored to be asked to be there, much to speak. I mean, like you said, there are great people up there.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive. All right, well, now let's, because I don't want to interfere with your golf game. What do you hit?
I am going to hit my drive.
Okay, yeah, let's hear it now. Let's hear the drive.
I'm now walking to my club.
Okay.
To pick it up.
And what are you going to hit? A 3-wood, a 1-wood, a driver? What is it going to
be? A 1-wood is also considered a driver.
Right.
I'm telling liberals about them.
He's checking with us.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, I'm going to put the phone down and now hit my shot. Hold on.
Okay, and Richard, we're looking at about 250 yards to the green, par 4. Richard's using the 1-wood. He's had a little trouble with this lately. Driving a little bit to his left. He's made some small adjustments with his stance. And there he is.
You hit a very good ball. Since I have been on the show with you, I have hit very good.
Well, there you go. Well. You know, that's what it's all about. It's about relaxing. Sometimes they say you play golf better when you're not really there.
That's exactly right. But I also hit my driver. Do you want to hear the story of my driver? I'll tell you real quick.
Oh, yeah, please.
One time for charity. It's like ridiculous, but you know these things. For charity, I was auctioned off for lunch on like eBay or something, and somebody could pay to have lunch with me. It's ridiculous, but nevertheless, it happened.
I would do it.
So, okay. You, I want to have coffee with. All I want to do is have coffee.
Yeah,
but anyway, this guy who's a violin maker in Japan, who a lovely man named Louis Caparelli. He's a violin maker, an American who moved to Japan, and he probably missed America and American TV. So he bid on me, and we had lunch. And I had a lovely time. And then about a year and a half, 2 years later, he calls to say he's in L.A. Do I want to get together for dinner or drink? And I said, I can't because I'm doing a play, but come see the play. And he comes, and then I invite him for drinks afterwards, and we have a lovely time. To say thank you, he was making a violin for the president of this very, very wonderful golf corporation in Japan called Hanma, H-O-N-M-A.
Uh-huh.
And their clubs are way too expensive for America, you know, to get them over here, and they're really beautiful. And he had the president make me a driver.
Wow.
And that's what I'm hitting. If you were to see this thing, it's so beautiful. It's gold. It's really beautiful. And it's like worth $1,500,
$2,000. Oh, my God.
And that's, so it really is nice. So that's what I just hit, and I hit well.
You really choose your dinner partners well.
Yes, I do. I was very, very lucky. All right, what is the question? What do you need to ask me? Because I'm going to be hitting
the
ball.
What is
really,
the movie
really
that you would recommend for me to see on Netflix? Either this weekend or maybe coming up during the school vacation.
The movie that I tell everybody to rent because people have not seen it, but it is the best of its kind. It's hilarious. It's fun. It's interesting. It's a great movie. Witness for the Prosecution.
I've never even heard of it.
Witness for the Prosecution. It's made in 1959. It's Charles Laughton. Elsa Lanchester, Marlena Dietrich, Tyrone Power, directed by Billy Wilder, based on an Agatha Christie.
Witness for the Prosecution.
And,
what's so great about
Witness
it?
Witness for the Prosecution. It's fantastic. Everything is great about it. Everything. I can't begin to tell you how great a movie it is.
Wow.
It's just fun. It's a fun, great. It's black and white, so you got to, you know, there are people who don't like black and white.
Well, I'm not one of those.
Great.
No. Well, that's fantastic.
Okay. Yeah, can you hold on 1 second? I'm going to hit my ball. Can you hold on just for
yes,
one more second, please?
Here we go. Okay, this is Richard's second shot. Ooh, sounds like a 7-iron. And Richard pulling the 7-iron. It's got about 150 yards to the pin. Probably should be using a 6-iron here. Richard's not quite got the distance with that 7-iron that one might want. And there you go.
It's the first bad shot I hit. That's the first bad shot I hit, and yet I got away with it.
What were you hitting?
I hit a 4-iron, but it did not go. I didn't hit it like I wanted.
6-iron, like I suggested. I should be caddying for you. Well,
yes, you should.
Richard, I can't thank you enough. In the movie this week, folks, okay. Witness for the Prosecution.
Witness for the Prosecution, directed by Billy Wilder. Don't get any other version. There was one made with, I think, Elliot Gould and Sybil. So not good. See the original Witness for the Prosecution with Tyrone Power, Charles Laughton, Elsa Lanchester, Marlena Dietrich. I guarantee you the time of your life. I guarantee you. I guarantee you. That is an absolute 4-star movie and nothing short.
Well, if I like nothing it, then short of a 4-star I will movie. Take you out for a cup of coffee one of these days.
Please, for God's sakes. Oh, I think I've got myself a cup of coffee. I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Richard Kind, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
Sam, I'll see you soon. Okay. All right. Thanks, buddy. Bye-bye.
All right, folks. Going to head into the better half of the program. Remember, it is your membership which supports this program. Movie recommendations from the great Richard Kind. Where can you get that? Such anger and passion about these horses. Where can you find that? What's going on, Matt? La Poupée.
Yes, I know.
What? It's...
My finger slipped and hit the wrong song. I knew exactly which... They're right next to each other.
Boy, we just need to get a vacation, don't we?
I'm fighting this cold. This cold.
Matt, it's just getting sicker and sicker. Oh, my God. All right, folks, it's your membership which keep this show alive, except for that person who I fired the other day. Not been a great month for memberships. Could certainly use your support, but I say that every day, so what am I going to say? You can support this program also by buying your Amazon junk through our Amazon link. It costs you nothing, but it makes us very happy. Simply go to majority.fm, click on support the show, click on our Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon junk through there, whether it's your Kindle purchases or your streaming purchases or your boat or your gardening supplies or your whatever it is you buy. I think my dad bought a small rototiller through that. It supports the program. Also, give us a review on iTunes. DonateYourAccount.com. Let us catch up to those whippersnappers over at Citizen Radio. JustCoffee.coop. Coffee, tea, chocolate. Chocolate. Yeah, chocolate. Fair trade. Organic. 10% coupon code. Majority gets 10% off. Or the coupon code. Majority gets you 10% off. Join us in the better half of the program. We'll have our song of the week. 646-257-3920 if you want to place a phone call. I am at Majority FM. A couple of stories. Nikki Haley, South Carolina. Is she about to get indicted for some type of tax fraud? Could be. Catherine Lehman. Who is she? Republican operative. Has her come to... In parens, gay Jesus moment. Interesting story. And how much did the mild winter, by mild I mean fourth hottest in a couple hundred years, play in part of the economic recovery? All that and more in the better half. See you there.